times in just about every act I've committed, and coming face to face with these truths, there is no catharsis. I gain no deeper knowledge about myself, no new understanding can be extracted from my telling. There has been no reason for me to tell you any of this. This confession has meant nothing. I'm asking Jean, how many people in this world are like me? She pauses, carefully answers, I don't think anyone. She's guessing. Let me rephrase the quest. Wait, how does my hair look? I ask, interrupting myself. Fine. Okay, let me rephrase the question. I take a sip of her dry beer. Okay, why do you like me? I ask. She asks back. Why? Yes, I say. Why? Well, a drop of beer has fallen onto my polo shirt. She hands me her napkin, a practical gesture that touches me.
You're concerned with others? She says tentatively. That's a very rare thing in what,
she stops again,
is, I guess, a hedonistic world. This is, Patrick, you're embarrassing me.
She shakes her head, closing her eyes. Go on, I urge. Please, I want to know.
You're sweet.
She rolls her eyes up.
Sweetness is sexy, I don't know, but so is mystery.
Silence.
And I think, mystery, you're mysterious.
Silence followed by a sigh.
And you're considerate.
She realizes something, no longer scared, stares at me straight on.
And I think shy men are romantic.
How many people in this world are like me? I ask again. Do I really appear like that?
Patrick, she says, I wouldn't lie.
No, of course you wouldn't, but I think that... My turn to sigh contemplatively.
I think...
You know how they say, no two snowflakes are ever alike? She nods. Well, I don't think that's true. I think a lot of snowflakes are alike. And I think a lot of people are alike, too. She nods again, though I can tell she's very confused. Appearances can be deceiving, I admit carefully.
No,
she says, shaking her head, sure of herself for the first time.
I don't think they are deceiving. They're not.
Sometimes, Jean, I explain, the line separating appearance, what you see, and reality, what you don't, become, well, blurred.
That's not true, she insists. That's simply not true.
Really? I ask, smiling.
I didn't used to think so, she says. Maybe 10 years ago I didn't, but I do now.
What do you mean? I ask, interested. You used to? A flood of reality. I get an odd feeling that this is a crucial moment in my life, and I'm startled by the suddenness of what I guess passes for an epiphany. There is nothing of value I can offer her. For the first time, I see Jean as uninhibited. She seems stronger, less controllable, wanting to take me into a new and unfamiliar land, the dreaded uncertainty of a totally different world. I sense she wants to rearrange my life in a significant way. Her eyes tell me this, and though I see truth in them, I also know that one day, sometime very soon, she too will be locked in the rhythm of my insanity. All I have to do is keep silent about this and not bring it up. Yet she weakens me. It's almost as if she's making the decision about who I am. And in my own stubborn, willful way, I can admit to feeling a pang, something tightening inside. And before I can stop it, I find myself almost dazzled and moved that I might have the capacity to accept, though not return, her love. I wonder if even now, right here in nowheres, she can see the darkening clouds behind my eyes lifting. And though the coldness I have always felt leaves me, the numbness doesn't,
and probably never will. This relationship will probably lead to nothing. This didn't change anything. I imagine her smelling clean, like tea.
Patrick, talk to me. Don't be so upset, she is saying.
I think it's time for me to take a good look at the world I've created. I choke tearfully, finding myself admitting to her, I came upon a half gram of cocaine in my armoire last night. I'm squeezing my hands together, forming one large fist, all knuckles white.
What did you do with it? She asks.
I place one hand on the table. She takes it.
I threw it away.
I threw it all away. I wanted to do it, I gasp, but I threw it away. She squeezes my hand tightly.
Patrick,
she asks, moving her hand up until it's gripping my elbow. When I find the strength to look back at her, it strikes me how useless, boring, physically beautiful she really is, and the question, why not end up with her, floats into my line of vision. An answer, she has a better body than most other girls I know. Another one, everyone is interchangeable anyway. One more, it doesn't really matter. She sits before me, sullen but hopeful, characterless, about to dissolve into tears. I squeeze her hand back, moved, no, touched by her ignorance of evil. She has one more test to pass.
Do you own a briefcase? I ask her, swallowing. No, she says. I don't.
Evelyn carries a briefcase, I mention.
She does?
Jean asks. And what about a Filofax?
A small one, she admits.
Designer? I ask suspiciously. No. I sigh, then take her hand, small and hard, in mine. And in the southern deserts of Sudan, the heat rises in airless waves. Thousands upon thousands of men, women, children roam throughout the vast bushland, desperately seeking food, ravaged and starving. Leaving a trail of dead, emaciated bodies, they eat weeds and leaves and lily pads, stumbling from village to village, dying slowly, inexorably. A gray morning in the miserable desert, grit flies through the air. A child with a face like a black moon lies in the sand, scratching at his throat, cones of dust rising, flying across land like whirling tops. No one can see the sun. The child is covered with sand, almost dead, eyes unblinking, grateful. Stop and imagine for an instant a world where someone is grateful for something. None of the haggard pay attention as they file by, dazed and in pain. No, there is one who pays attention, who notices the boy's agony and smiles as if holding a secret. The boy opens and closes his cracked, chapped mouth soundlessly. There is a school bus in the distance somewhere, and somewhere else, above that, in space, a spirit rises, a door opens, it asks, why? A home for the dead, an infinity. It hangs in a void, time limps by, love and sadness rush through the boy.
Okay.
I am dimly aware of a phone ringing somewhere. In the cafe on Columbus, countless numbers, hundreds of people, maybe thousands, have walked by our table during my silence.
Patrick?
Jean says. Someone with a baby stroller stops at the corner and purchases a Dove bar. The baby stares at Jean and me. We stare back. It's really weird, and I'm experiencing a spontaneous kind of internal sensation. I feel I'm moving toward, as well as away from, something. And anything is possible. Aspen. It is 4 days before Christmas, at 2 in the afternoon. I'm sitting in the back of a pitch-black limousine, parked in front of a nondescript brownstone off 5th Avenue, trying to read an article about Donald Trump in the new issue of Fame magazine. Jeanette wants me to come in with her, but I say forget it.
She has a black eye from last night, since I had to coerce her over dinner at Il Marlborough to even consider doing this. Then, after a more forceful discussion at my apartment, she consented. Jeanette's dilemma lies outside my definition of guilt, and I had told her, truthfully, over dinner, that it was very hard for me to express concern for her that I don't feel. During the entire drive from my place on the Upper West Side, she's been sobbing. The only clear, identifiable emotion coming from her is desperation, and maybe longing. And though I successfully ignore her for most of the ride, I finally have to tell her, "Listen, I've already taken 2 Xanax this morning, so, you're incapable of, like, upsetting me." Now as she stumbles out of the limo onto the frozen pavement, I mumble, "It's for the best," and offering consolation, "Don't take it so seriously." The driver, whose name I've forgotten, leads her into the brownstone, and she gives a last regretful look back. I sigh and wave her off. She's still wearing, from last night, a leopard-print cotton Balmacan coat with wood chalice lining over a wool-crepe shirtless dress by Bill Blass. Bigfoot was interviewed on the Patty Winters show this morning, and to my shock I found him surprisingly articulate and charming. The glass I'm drinking absolute vodka from is Finnish. I'm very suntanned compared to Jeanette. The driver comes out of the building, gives me thumbs up, carefully pulls the limousine away from the curb, and begins the trek to JFK Airport, where my flight to Aspen leaves in 90 minutes. When I get back in January, Jeanette will be out of the country. I relight a cigar, search for an ashtray. There's a church on the corner of this street. Who cares? This is, I think, the 5th child I've had aborted. The 3rd I haven't aborted myself. A useless statistic, I admit. The wind outside the limousine is brisk and cold, and the rain hits the darkened windows in rhythmic waves, mimicking Jeanette's probable weeping in the operating room. Dizzy from the anesthesia, thinking about a memory from her past, a moment where the world was perfect. I resist the impulse to start cackling hysterically. At the airport, I instruct the chauffeur to stop by FAO Schwartz before picking Jeanette up and purchase the following. A doll, a rattle, a teething ring, a white-gunned polar bear, and have them sitting in the back seat for her, unwrapped. Jeanette should be okay. She has her whole life in front of her. That is, if she doesn't run into me. Besides, this girl's favorite movie is Pretty in Pink, and she thinks Sting is cool. So what is happening to her is, like, not totally undeserved, and one shouldn't feel bad for her. This is no time for the innocent. Valentine's Day. Tuesday morning, and I'm standing by my desk in the living room on the phone with my lawyer, alternately keeping my eye on the Patty Winters show and the maid as she waxes the floor, wipes blood smears off the walls, throws away gore-soaked newspapers without a word. Faintly it hits me that she too is lost in a world of shit, completely drowning in it, and this somehow sets off my remembering that the piano tuner will be stopping by this afternoon and that I should leave a note with the doorman to let him in. Not that the Yamaha has ever been played. It's just that one of the girls fell against it and some strings, which I used later, were pulled out, snapped or something. Into the phone I'm saying, "I need more tax breaks." Patty Winters is on the TV screen asking a child, 8 or 9, "But isn't that just another term for an orgy?" The timer buzzes on the microwave. I'm heating up a souffle. There's no use in denying it. This has been a bad week. I've started drinking my own urine. I laugh spontaneously at nothing. Sometimes I sleep under my futon. I'm flossing my teeth constantly until my gums are aching and my mouth tastes like blood. Before dinner last night at 1500 with Reed Goodrich and Jason Rust, I was almost caught at a Federal Express in Times Square trying to send the mother of one of the girls I killed last week what might be a dried-up brown heart. And to Evelyn I successfully Federal Expressed, through the office, a small box of flies, along with a note, typed by Jean, saying that I never, ever wanted to see her face again, and though she doesn't really need one, to go on a fucking diet. but there are also things that the average person would think are nice that I've done to celebrate the holiday. Items I've bought Jean and had delivered to her apartment this morning. Castellini cotton napkins from Bendel's, a wicker chair from Jenny B. Good, a taffeta table throw from Barney's, a vintage chainmail vent purse, and a vintage sterling silver dresser set from Macy's, a white pine whatnot from Conran's, an Edwardian 9-carat gold gate bracelet from Bergdorf's, and hundreds upon hundreds of pink and white roses. The Office. Lyrics to Madonna songs keep intruding, bursting into my head, announcing themselves in tiring, familiar ways, and I stare into space, my eyes lazily lit up while I try to forget about the day looming before me. But then a phrase that fills me with a nameless dread keeps interrupting the Madonna songs. Isolated farmhouse constantly returns to me over and over. Someone I've been avoiding for the last year, a nerd from Fortune, who wants to write an article about me, calls again this morning, and I end up calling the reporter back to arrange an interview. Craig McDermott is having some kind of fax frenzy and won't take any of my phone calls, preferring to communicate by fax only. The Post this morning says the remains of three bodies that disappeared aboard a yacht last March have been recovered, frozen in ice, hacked up and bloated in the East River. Some maniac is going around the city poisoning 1-liter bottles of Evian water. 17 dead already. Talk of zombies, the public mood, increasing randomness, vast chasms of misunderstanding. And for the sake of form, Tim Price resurfaces. Or at least I'm pretty sure he does. While I'm at my desk simultaneously crossing out the days in my calendar that have already passed and reading a new bestseller about office management called Why It Works to Be a Jerk, Jean buzzes in, announcing that Tim Price wants to talk, and fearfully I say, "Send him in." Price strolls into the office, wearing a wool suit by Canali Milano, a cotton shirt by Ike Behar, a silk tie by Bill Blass, cap-toed leather lace-ups from Brooks Brothers. I'm pretending to be on the phone. He sits down across from me, on the other side of the Palazzetti glass-top desk. There's a smudge on his forehead, or at least that's what I think I see. Aside from that, he looks remarkably fit. Our conversation probably resembles something like this, but is actually briefer. "Price," I say, shaking his hand. "Where have you been?" "Oh, just making the rounds," he smiles. "But hey, I'm back." "Far out," I shrug, confused. "How was it?" "It was surprising," he shrugs too. "It was depressing." "I thought I saw you in Aspen," I murmur. "Hey, how are you, Bateman?" he asks. "I'm okay," I tell him, swallowing. "Just existing." "And Evelyn?" he asks. "How is she?" "Well, we broke up," I smile. "That's too bad." He takes this in, remembers something. "Courtney?" "She married Lewis." "Grass Green?" "No, Carruthers." He takes this in, too. "Do you have her number?" While writing it down for him, I mention, "You've been gone, like, forever, Tim. What's the story?" I ask, again noticing the smudge on his forehead, though I get the feeling that if I asked someone else if it was truly there, he or she would just say no. He stands up, takes the card. "I've been back. You just probably missed me. Lost track. Because of the move." He pauses teasingly. "I'm working for Robinson. Right-hand man, you know?" "Almond?" I ask, offering one, a futile effort on my part to mask my dismay at his smugness. He pats my back, says, "You're a madman, Bateman. An animal. A total animal." "I can't disagree." I laugh weakly, walking him to the door. As he leaves, I'm wondering, and not wondering, what happens in the world of Tim Price, which is really the world of most of us. Big ideas, guy stuff,
Boy meets the world, boy gets it.
Bomb on Fifth. I'm coming back from Central Park, where, near the children's zoo, close to the spot I murdered the McCaffrey boy, I fed portions of Ursula's brain to passing dogs. Walking down Fifth Avenue around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, everyone on the street looks sad. The air is full of decay. Bodies lie on the cold pavement, miles of it. Some are moving, most are not. History is sinking, and only a very few seem dimly aware that things are getting bad. Airplanes fly low across the city, crossing in front of the sun. Winds shoot up Fifth, then funnel down 57th Street. Flocks of pigeons rise in slow motion and burst up against the sky. The smell of burning chestnuts mixes with carbon monoxide fumes. I notice the skyline has changed only recently. I look up, admiringly, at Trump Tower, tall, proudly gleaming in the late afternoon sunlight. In front of it, two smart-ass nigger teenagers are ripping off tourists at Three Card Monty, and I have to fight the impulse to blow them away. A bum I blinded one spring sits cross-legged on a ratty blanket near the corner of 55th Street. Moving closer, I see the beggar's scarred face, and then the sign he's holding beneath it, which reads, "Vietnam Vet, blinded in Vietnam. Please help me. We are hungry and homeless." We? Then I notice the dog, who is already eyeing me suspiciously and, as I approach its master, gets up, growling. And when I'm standing over the bum, it finally barks, wagging its tail frantically. I kneel down, threateningly raise a hand at it. The dog backs off, its paws askew. I've pulled out my wallet, pretending to drop a dollar into his empty coffee can, but then realize, why bother pretending? No one's watching anyway. Definitely not him. I retract the dollar, leaning in. He senses my presence and stops shaking the can. The sunglasses he wears don't even begin to cover the wounds I inflicted. His nose is so junked up I can't imagine a person breathing through it.
"You never were in Vietnam," I whisper in his ear. After a silence during which he pisses in his pants, the dog whimpering, he croaks, "Please, don't hurt me."
"Why would I waste my time?" I mutter, disgusted. I move away from the bum, noticing instead a little girl smoking a cigarette, begging for change outside Trump Tower. "Shoo," I say. She says "shoo" back. On the Patty Winters show this morning, a Cheerio sat in a very small chair and was interviewed for close to an hour. Later this afternoon, a woman wearing a silver fox and mink coat has her face slashed in front of the Stanhope by an enraged fur activist. But now, still staring at the sightless bum from across the street, I buy a Dove bar, a coconut one, in which I find part of a bone. New Club. Thursday night I run into Harold Carnes at a party for a new club called World's End that opens in a space where Petty's used to be on the Upper East Side. I'm with Nina Goodrich and Jean in a booth, and Harold standing at the bar drinking champagne. I'm drunk enough to finally confront him about the message I left on his machine. Excused from the booth, I make my way to the other side of the bar, realizing that I need a martini to fortify myself before discussing this with Carnes. It has been a very unstable week for me. I found myself sobbing during an episode of ALF on Monday. Nervously, I approach. Harold is wearing a wool suit by Jeeves and Hawks, a silk twill tie, cotton shirt, shoes by Paul Stewart. He looks heavier than I remember. "Face it," he's telling Truman Drake, "the Japanese will own most of this country by the end of the 90s. Relieved that Harold is, as usual, still dispensing valuable and new information, with the addition of a faint but unmistakable trace of, God forbid, an English accent, I find myself brazen enough to blurt out, "Shut up, Carnes, they will not." I down the martini, stolely, while Carnes, looking quite taken aback, stricken almost, turns around to face me. And his bloated head breaks out into an uncertain smile. Someone behind us is saying, "But look what happened to Gecko!" Truman Drake pats Harold on the back and asks me, "Is there one suspender width that's more, well, appropriate than others?" Irritably, I push him into the crowd and he disappears. "So, Harold," I say, "did you get my message?" Carnes seems confused at first, and while lighting a cigarette, finally laughs. "Jesus, Davis! Yes, that was hilarious! That was you, was it?" "Yes, naturally," I'm blinking, muttering to myself, really, waving his cigarette smoke away from my face. "Bateman killing Owen, and the escort girl?" He keeps chuckling. "Oh, that's bloody marvelous. Really key, as they say at the Groucho Club. Really key." Then, looking dismayed, he adds, "It was a rather long message, no?" I'm smiling idiotically, and then I say, "But what exactly do you mean, Harold?" Secretly thinking to myself that this fat bastard couldn't possibly have gotten into the fucking Groucho Club. And even if he had, to admit it in such a fashion obliterates the fact that his entrance was accepted. "Why, the message you left." Carnes is already looking around the club, waving to various people and bimbos. "By the way, Davis, how is Cynthia?" He accepts a glass of champagne from a passing waiter. "You're still seeing her, right?" "But wait, Harold. What do you mean?" I repeat emphatically. He's already bored, neither concerned nor listening, and excusing himself, he says, "Nothing. Good to see you. Oh my, is that Edward Towers?" I crane my neck to look, then back to Harold. "No," I say, "Carnes, wait." "Davis," he sighs as if patiently trying to explain something to a child, "I am not one to badmouth anyone. Your joke was amusing. But come on, man, you had one fatal flaw. Bateman, such a bloody ass-kisser, such a brown-nosing goody-goody, that I couldn't fully appreciate it. Otherwise, it was amusing. Now let's have lunch. Or we'll have dinner at 150 Worcester or something with McDermott or Preston. A real raver." He tries to move on. "Raver? Raver? Did you say raver, Carnes?" I'm wide-eyed, feeling wired even though I haven't done any drugs. "What are you talking about? Bateman is what?" "Oh, good God, man. Why else would Evelyn Richards dump him? You know, really, he could barely pick up an escort girl, let alone... What was it you said he did to her?" Harold is still looking distractedly around the club, and he waves to another couple, raising his champagne glass. "Oh, yes, chop her up." He starts laughing again, though this time it sounds polite. "Now, if you'll excuse me, I must, really..." "Wait, stop!" I shout, looking up into Carnes' face, making sure he's listening. "You don't seem to understand. You're not really comprehending any of this. I killed him. I did it, Carnes. I chopped Owen's fucking head off. I tortured dozens of girls. That whole message I left on your machine was true." I'm drained, not appearing calm, wondering why this doesn't feel like a blessing to me. "Excuse me," he says, trying to ignore my outburst. "I really must be going." "No," I shout. "Now, Carnes, listen to me. Listen very, very carefully. I killed Paul Owen and I liked it. I can't make myself any clearer." My stress causes me to choke on the words. "But that's simply not possible," he says, brushing me off, "and I'm not finding this amusing anymore." "It never was supposed to be," I bellow, and then, "Why isn't it possible?" "It's just not," he says, eyeing me worriedly. "Why not?" I shout again over the music, though there's really no need to, adding, "You stupid bastard." He stares at me as if we are both underwater, and shouts back, very clearly, over the din of the club, "Because I had dinner with Paul Owen twice in London just 10 days ago." After we stare at each other for what seems like a minute, I finally have the nerve to say something back to him.
but my voice lacks any authority, and I'm not sure if I believe myself when I tell him simply, "No, you didn't." But it comes out a question, not a statement. "Now, Donaldson," Carnes says, removing my hand from his arm, "if you'll excuse me."
"Oh, you're excused," I sneer.
Then I make my way back to our booth, where John Edmonton and Peter Beavers are now sitting, and I numb myself with a Halcyon before taking Jean home, back to my place. Jean is wearing something by Oscar de la Renta. Nina Goodrich was wearing a sequin dress by Matsuda and refused to give me her number, even though Jean was in the women's room downstairs. Taxi driver. Another broken scene in what passes for my life occurs on Wednesday, seemingly pointing to someone's fault, though whose I can't be sure. Stuck in gridlock in a cab heading downtown toward Wall Street after a power breakfast at the Regency with Peter Russell, who used to be my dealer before he got a real job, and Eddie Lambert. Russell was wearing a two-button wool sport coat by Radili, a cotton shirt by Hackert, a silk tie by Rochelle, pleated wool trousers by Krizia Umo, and leather Cole Haan shoes. The Patty Winters show this morning was about girls in the fourth grade who trade sex for crack, and I almost canceled with Lambert and Russell to catch it. Russell ordered for me while I was in the lobby on the phone. It was, unfortunately, a high-fat, high-sodium breakfast, and before I could comprehend what was happening, plates of herbed waffles with ham in Madeira cream sauce, grilled sausages, and sour cream coffee cake were set at our table, and I had to ask the waiter for a pot of decaf herbal tea, a plate of sliced mango with blueberries, and a bottle of Evian. In the early morning light that poured through the windows at the Regency, I watched as our waiter shaved black truffles gracefully over Lambert's steaming eggs. Overcome, I broke down and demanded to have the black truffles shaved over my mango slices. Nothing much happened during the breakfast. I had to make another phone call, and when I returned to our table, I noticed that a mango slice was missing, but I didn't accuse anyone. I had other things on my mind. How to help America's schools, the trust gap, desk sets, a new era of possibilities, and what's in it for me, getting tickets to see Sting in the Threepenny Opera, which just opened on Broadway, how to take more and remember less. In the cab, I'm wearing a double-breasted cashmere and wool overcoat by Studio 000.1 from Foray, a wool suit with pleated trousers by De Rigueur from Schoenman, a silk tie by Givenchy Gentleman, socks by Interwoven, shoes by Armani, reading the Wall Street Journal with my Ray-Ban sunglasses on and listening to a Walkman with a Bix Beiderbecke tape playing in it. I put down the journal, pick up the Post, just to check page 6. At the light on 7th and 34th, in the cab next to this one sits, I think, Kevin Gladwin, wearing a suit by Ralph Lauren. I lower my sunglasses. Kevin looks up from the new issue of Money magazine and spots me looking over at him in a curious way before his cab moves forward in the traffic. The cab I'm in suddenly breaks free of the gridlock and turns right on 27th, taking the West Side Highway down to Wall Street. I put the paper down, concentrate on the music and the weather, how unseasonably cool it is, and I'm just beginning to notice the way the cab driver looks at me in the rearview mirror. A suspicious, hungry expression keeps changing the features on his face, a mass of clogged pores, ingrown hairs. I sigh, expecting this, ignoring him. Open the hood of a car and it will tell you something about the people who designed it, is just one of the many phrases I'm tortured by. But the driver knocks on the plexiglass divider, motions to me. While taking the Walkman off, I notice he's locked all the doors. I see the locks lower in a flash, hear the hollow clicking noise, the moment I turn the volume off. The cab is speeding faster than it should down the highway, in the far right lane. "Yes?" I ask irritably. "What?"
"Hey, don't I know you?"
he asks in a thick, barely penetrable accent that could easily be either New Jersey or Mediterranean. "No," I start putting the Walkman back on.
"You look familiar," he says. "What's your name?"
"No, I don't." "You don't either," I say, then an afterthought. Chris Hagen.
Come on. He's smiling like there's something wrong. I know who you are.
I'm in a movie. I'm an actor. I tell him, a model.
No, that's not it, he says grimly.
Well, I lean over, checking his name. Abdullah, do you have a membership at MK? He doesn't answer. I reopen the post to a photo of the mayor dressed as a pineapple, then close it again and rewind the tape in my Walkman. I start counting to myself. 1, 2, 3, 4. My eyes focus in on the meter. Why didn't I carry a gun with me this morning? Because I didn't think I had to. The only weapon on me is a used knife from last night.
No, he says again. I've seen your face somewhere.
Finally exasperated, I ask, trying to appear casual. You have? Really? Interesting. Just watch the road, Abdullah. There's a long, scary pause, while he stares at me in the rearview mirror, and the grim smile fades. His face is blank. He says,
I know. Man, I know who you are.
And he's nodding, his mouth drawn tight. The radio that was tuned into the news is shut off. Buildings pass by in a gray-red blur. The cab passes other cabs. The sky changes color from blue to purple to black, back to blue. At another light, a red one, he races straight through. We pass, on the other side of the West Side Highway, a new D'Agostino's, on the corner where Mars used to be, and it moves me to tears, almost, because it's something that's identifiable, and I get as nostalgic for the market, even though it's not one I will ever shop at, as I have about anything, and I almost interrupt the driver, tell him to pull over, have him let me out, let him keep the change from a 20, but I can't move, because he's driving too fast, and something intervenes, something unthinkable and ludicrous, and I hear him say it, maybe,
You're the guy who killed Soli.
His face is locked into a determined grimace. As with everything else, the following happens very quickly, though it feels like an endurance test. I swallow, lower my sunglasses, and tell him to slow down before asking, Who, may I ask, is Sally?
Man, your face is on a wanted poster downtown, he says, unflinching.
I think I would like to stop here, I manage to croak out.
You're the guy, right?
He's looking at me like I'm some kind of viper. Another cab, its light on, empty, cruises past ours, going at least 80. I'm not saying anything, just shaking my head. I am going to take... I swallow, trembling open my leather date book, pull out a Montblanc pen from my Bottega Veneta briefcase, your license number down.
You kill Soli,
he says, definitely recognizing me from somewhere, cutting another denial on my part by growling,
You son of a bitch!
Near the docks downtown, he swerves off the highway and races the cab toward the end of a deserted parking area, and it hits me somewhere now, this moment, when he drives into and then over a dilapidated rust-covered aluminum fence heading toward water, that all I have to do is put the Walkman on, blot out the sound of the cab driver, but my hands are twisted into paralyzed fists that I can't unclench, held captive in the cab as it hurtles toward a destination only the cab driver, who is obviously deranged, knows. The windows are rolled down partially, and I can feel the cool morning air drying the mousse on my scalp. I feel naked, suddenly tiny. My mouth tastes metallic, then it gets worse. My vision, a winter road. But I'm left with one comforting thought. I am rich. Millions are not.
You've, like, incorrectly identified me, I'm saying.
He stops the cab and turns around toward the back seat. He's holding a gun, the make of which I don't recognize. I'm staring at him, my quizzical expression changing into something else.
The watch, the Rolex,
he says simply. I listen, silent, squirming in my seat. He repeats,
The watch!
Is this some kind of prank? I ask.
Get out, he spits. Get the fuck out of the car.
I stare past the driver's head out the windshield, at gulls flying low over the dark, wavy water, and opening the door, I step out of the cab, cautiously, no sudden moves. It's a cold day. My breath steams. Wind picks it up, swirls it around.
The watch, you scumbag!
he says, leaning out the window, the gun aimed at my head. Listen, I don't know what you think you're doing, or what you're exactly trying to accomplish, or what it is you think you're going to be able to do. I've never been fingerprinted. I have alibis. Shut up, Abdullah growls, cutting me off. Just shut your fucking mouth. I am innocent, I shout with utter conviction. The watch! He cocks the gun. I unhook the Rolex and, sliding it off my wrist, hand it to him. Wallet, he motions with his gun. Just the cash. Helplessly, I take out my new gazelle skin wallet and quickly, my fingers freezing, numb, hand him the cash, which amounts to only $300, since I didn't have time to stop at an automated teller before the power breakfast. Solly, I'm guessing, was the cab driver I killed during the chase scene last fall, even though that guy was Armenian. I suppose I could have killed another one, and I am just not recalling this particular incident. What are you going to do? I ask. Isn't there a reward of some kind? No reward, he mutters, shuffling the bills with one hand, the gun still pointed at me in the other. How do you know I'm not going to call you in and get your license revoked? I ask, handing over a knife I just found in my pocket that looks as if it was dipped into a bowl of blood and hair. Because you're guilty, he says, and then, get that away from me, waving the gun at the stained knife. Like you know, I mutter angrily. The sunglasses, he points again with the gun. How do you know I'm guilty? I can't believe I'm asking this patiently. Look what you're doing, asshole, he says. The sunglasses. These are expensive, I protest, then sigh, realizing the mistake. I mean, cheap. They're very cheap. Just, isn't the money enough? The sunglasses. Give them now, he grunts. I take the wayfarers off and hand them to him. Maybe I really did kill a Solly, though I'm positive that any cab drivers I've killed lately were not American. I probably did. There probably is a wanted poster of me at where the taxi, the place where all the taxis congregate, what's it called? The driver tries the sunglasses on, looks at himself in the rearview mirror, and then takes them off. He folds the glasses and puts them in his jacket pocket. You're a dead man. I smile grimly at him. And you're a yuppie scumbag, he says. You're a dead man, Abdullah, I repeat, no joke. Count on it. Yeah, and you're a yuppie scumbag. Which is worse? He starts the cab up and pulls away from me. While walking back to the highway, I stop, choke back a sob, my throat tightens. I just want to... Facing the skyline, through all the baby talk, I murmur, keep the game going. As I stand frozen in position, an old woman emerges behind a three-penny opera poster at a deserted bus stop, and she's homeless and begging, hobbling over, her face covered with sores that look like bugs, holding out a shaking red hand. Oh, will you please go away? I sigh. She tells me to get a haircut. At Harry's. On a Friday evening, a group of us have left the office early, finding ourselves at Harry's. Group consists of Tim Price, Craig McDermott, myself, Preston Goodrich, who is currently dating a total hardbody named, I think, Plum. No last name, just Plum, an actress model, which I have a feeling we all think is pretty hip. We're having a debate over where to make reservations for dinner. Flamingo East, Oyster Bar, 220, Counterlife, Michaels, Spago East, Le Cirque. Robert Farrell is here, too. The Lotus Quotrek, a portable stock quotation device in front of him on the table, and he's pushing buttons while the latest commodities flash by. What are people wearing? McDermott has on a cashmere sport coat, wool trousers, a silk tie, Hermes. Farrell is wearing a cashmere vest, leather shoes, wool cavalry twill trousers, Garrick Anderson. I'm wearing a wool suit by Armani, shoes by Allen Edmonds, pocket square by Brooks Brothers. Someone else has on a suit tailored by Anderson and Shepard. Someone who looks like Todd Lauder, and may in fact be, gives thumbs up from across the room, etc., etc. Questions are routinely thrown my way,
among them. Are the rules for wearing a pocket square the same as for a white dinner jacket? Is there any difference at all between boat shoes and topsiders? My futon has already flattened out, and it's uncomfortable to sleep on. What can I do? How does one judge the quality of compact discs before buying them? What tie knot is less bulky than a Windsor? How can one maintain a sweater's elasticity? Any tips on buying a shearling coat? I am, of course, thinking about other things, asking myself my own questions. Am I a fitness junkie? Man versus conformity? Can I get a date with Cindy Crawford? Does being a Libra signify anything, and if so, can you prove it? Today I was obsessed with the idea of faxing Sarah's blood I drained from her vagina over to her office in the mergers division at Chase Manhattan, and I didn't work out this morning, because I'd made a necklace from the bones of some girl's vertebrae and wanted to stay home and wear it around my neck while I masturbated in the white marble tub in my bathroom, grunting and moaning like some kind of animal. Then I watched a movie about 5 lesbians and 10 vibrators. Favorite group, Talking Heads. Drink, J&B, or Absolute on the rocks. TV show, Late Night with David Letterman. Soda, Diet Pepsi. Water, Evian. Sport, baseball. The conversation follows its own rolling accord. No real structure or topic or internal logic or feeling, except, of course, for its own hidden conspiratorial one. Just words. And like in a movie, but one that has been transcribed improperly, most of it overlaps. I'm having a sort of hard time paying attention, because my automated teller has started speaking to me. Sometimes actually leaving weird messages on the screen in green lettering, like, cause a terrible scene at Sotheby's, or kill the president, or feed me a stray cat. And I was freaked out by the park bench that followed me for 6 blocks last Monday evening, and it too spoke to me. Disintegration. I'm taking it in stride. Yet the only question I can muster up at first and add to the conversation is a worried, I'm not going anywhere if we don't have a reservation someplace, so do we have a reservation someplace or not? I notice that we're all drinking dry beers. Am I the only one who notices this? I'm also wearing mock tortoiseshell glasses that are non-prescription. On the TV screen in Harry's is the Patty Winters show, which is now on in the afternoon and is up against Geraldo Rivera, Phil Donahue, and Oprah Winfrey. Today's topic is, does economic success equal happiness? The answer, in Harry's this afternoon, is a roar of resounding, definitely, followed by much hooting. The guys all cheer together in a friendly way. On the screen now are scenes from President Bush's inauguration early this year, then a speech from former President Reagan, while Patty delivers a hard-to-hear commentary. Soon a tiresome debate forms over whether he's lying or not, even though we don't, can't hear the words. The first and really only one to complain is Price, who, though I think he's bothered by something else, uses this opportunity to vent his frustration, looks inappropriately stunned, and asks, "How can he lie like that? How can he pull that shit?" "Oh, Christ," I moan. "What shit?" "Now, where do we have reservations at? I mean, I'm not really hungry, but I would like to have reservations somewhere. How about 220? An afterthought. "McDermott, how did that rate in the News of Gats?" "No way," Farrell complains before Craig can answer. "The coke I scored there last time was cut with so much laxative I actually had to take a shit in MK. "Yeah, yeah, life sucks and then you die." "Low point of the night," Farrell mutters. "Weren't you with Kyria the last time you were there?" Goodrich asks. "Wasn't that the low point?" "She caught me on call waiting. What could I do?" Farrell shrugs. "I apologize." "Caught him on call waiting," McDermott nudges me, dubious. "Shut up, McDermott," Farrell says, snapping Craig's suspenders. "Date a beggar." "You forgot something, Farrell," Preston mentions. "McDermott is a beggar." "How's Courtney?" Farrell asks Craig, leering. "Just say no," someone laughs. Price looks away from the television screen, then at Craig, and he tries to hide his displeasure by asking me, waving at the TV, "I don't believe it. He looks so normal. He seems so
out of it so undangerous?
Bimbo, bimbo, someone says. Bypass, bypass.
He is totally harmless, you geek. Was totally harmless. Just like you are totally harmless. But he did do all that shit, and you have failed to get us into 150, so, you know, what can I say?
McDermott shrugs.
I just don't get how someone, anyone, can appear that way yet be involved in such total shit,
Price says, ignoring Craig, averting his eyes from Farrell. He takes out a cigar and studies it sadly. To me, it still looks like there's a smudge on Price's forehead.
Because Nancy was right behind him? Farrell guesses, looking up from the Quotrek. Because Nancy did it? How can you be so fucking, I don't know, cool about it?
Price, to whom something really eerie has obviously happened, sounds genuinely perplexed. Rumor has it that he was in rehab.
Some guys are just born cool, I guess.
Farrell smiles, shrugging. I'm laughing at this answer, since Farrell is so obviously uncool. And Price shoots me a reprimanding look, says,
And Bateman, what are you so fucking zany about?
I shrug, too. I'm just a happy camper. And I add, remembering, quoting my brother, Rocking and a-rolling.
Be all that you can be, someone adds.
Oh, brother. Price won't let it die. Look. He starts trying for a rational appraisal of the situation.
He presents himself as a harmless old codger, but inside...
He stops. My interest picks up, flickers briefly.
But inside...
Price can't finish the sentence, can't add the last two words he needs. Doesn't matter. I'm both disappointed and relieved for him.
Inside, yes, inside... Craig asks, bored. Believe it or not, we're actually listening to you. Go on.
Bateman, Price says, relenting slightly.
Come on. What do you think?
I look up, smile, don't say anything. From somewhere. The TV? The national anthem plays. Why? I don't know. Before a commercial, maybe. Tomorrow, on the Patty Winters show, doormen from Nell's. Where are they now? I sigh, shrug. Whatever.
That's, a pretty good answer, Price says, then adds. You're a real nut.
That is the most valuable piece of information I've heard since... I look at my new gold Rolex that insurance paid for. McDermott suggested we all drink dry beers.
Christ, I want a scotch.
McDermott looks up with an exaggerated grin and purrs.
Bud, long neck, beautiful.
Very civilized, Goodrich nods. Super stylish English guy Nigel Morrison stops by our table, and he's wearing a flower in the lapel of his Paul Smith jacket. But he can't stay long since he has to meet other British friends, Ian and Lucy, at Delmonico's. Seconds after he walks away, I hear someone sneer,
Nigel, a pate animal.
Someone else,
Did you know that cavemen got more fiber than we do?
Who's handling the Fisher account?
Screw that. What about the Shepherd thing? The Shepherd account.
Is that David Monroe? What a burnout.
Oh, brother. For Christ's sakes. Lean and mean. What's in it for me? The Shepherd play or the Shepherd account?
Rich people with cheap stereos.
No, girls who can hold their liquor.
Total lightweight.
Need a light? Nice matches. What's in it for me?
Yup, 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 yup. I think it's me who says, I have to return some videotapes. Someone has already taken out a Minolta cellular phone and called for a car. And then, when I'm not really listening, watching instead someone who looks remarkably like Marcus Halberstam paying a check, someone asks, simply, not in relation to anything,
Why?
And though I'm very proud that I have cold blood, and that I can keep my nerve and do what I'm supposed to do, I catch something, then realize it.
Why?
And automatically answering out of the blue for no reason, just opening my mouth, words coming out, summarizing for the idiots. Well, though I know I should have done that instead of not doing it, I'm 27, for Christ's sakes, and this is,
how life presents itself in a bar or in a club in New York, maybe anywhere, at the end of the century, and how people, you know, me, behave. And this is what being Patrick means to me, I guess. So, well, yup. And this is followed by a sigh, then a slight shrug, and another sigh. And above one of the doors, covered by red velvet drapes in Harry's, is a sign, and on the sign, in letters that match the drape's color, are the words, "This is not an exit."
Hello, this is James Atlas, your host for Audible Modern Vanguard. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with best-selling author Bret Easton Ellis.
Hello.
Hi, Bret.
What is 973?
973 is a studio in New Jersey, and you probably have never been to New Jersey.
You know what? You make these assumptions about me,
James. I'm sorry.
You, of course I've been to New Jersey.
Okay.
Do you think I'm just this pampered weenie?
No, I don't think you're a pampered weenie.
Well, I often think I am, so well, I don't know.
But listen, I have to ask you, were you 19 when you wrote Less Than Zero?
I had written many different versions of the book that was ultimately published. It began with a kind of, almost a journalistic take on that material. I was writing, you know, I guess it was the equivalent of blogging in a way in those days, in terms of I would just write down whatever, you know, had happened to me during that weekend, or, you know, it was like I was keeping a diary, basically, and then I decided to turn it into fiction. But I had written, like, two novels that were similar to Less Than Zero, but much more fact-based. And then Less Than Zero was just the tumble into a totally fictional world.
How did someone as that age have so much information about cynical and disaffected stoners, promiscuous, remember the word alienated that we used to use? That's very precocious insights that you had.
Well, I hated my father.
And that did it? That's what makes one precocious?
Brett. Well, I look back on it and I see it as being kind of ambitious, you know? I see it as being, I never thought of myself as precocious, but I thought of myself as someone who, and it's as simple as this, James, it really is, as someone who really liked to write. And I just liked, I liked to write, and I liked to observe, and I liked to read, and I paid attention to adults. I was interested in the world of adults, and, you know, I admit it. I mean, I grew up here in L.A., and it was, it was slightly more permissive than other childhoods or adolescents when I make comparisons with my friends who grew up elsewhere. And I think that all, you know, came into the mix. So it wasn't a conscious yearning to understand this world. It just was something that I noticed and that I was interested in writing about. And, you know, it was the environment, I guess. I mean, I think Less Than Zero was very much influenced by the reportage of the New Journalism, and, you know, especially something like Joan Didion's Slouching Towards Bethlehem, where you're using, you know, fictional techniques in, you know, in journalism and nonfiction. And I definitely think Less Than Zero was influenced by that in terms of the style and how it's kind of, I don't know, it doesn't really feel so much as a full-fledged novel as it feels like. Though it is. I mean, I think it is that, but it also feels like journalism in a way, reportage, a kind of, you know, delving into a scene and trying to be as neutral and non-judgmental about it while also being an insider. But the books are all autobiographical to some degree or another because they pinpoint where I was emotionally at the time I was writing them. Someone asked, have you ever written a memoir or a memoiristic piece? And I said no, because the books really are the memoir. The books chart where I've been at every point in my life, what I've been thinking about, what I've been fantasizing about, what my obsessions are, what I'm concerned about. So Less Than Zero, you know, none of the things that go on in the book, you know, everyone said, oh, you must have led such a fast and racy life. You know, not really. Not that much more fast or racier than, you know, the average teen in L.A., once I realized that the material and the things that I was witnessing were going to become a novel, then yeah, it's ramped up a little bit. And I was very conscious of the stuff becoming a novel. But it doesn't mean that I was, you know, hanging out with corpses and, you know, fondling 12-year-old girls or whatever happens in the book. I mean, it's just, what I was most interested in about the book was this idea of passivity. And does the passive man in the culture, is he really the sane one because of the insane chaos that surrounds him? Or is he just as bad as the insane chaos around him because he doesn't act? And I was really interested in this idea, and it especially comes true in the last like 30 or 40 pages of the book, where this very passive, detached narrator does not stop a series of kind of bad events from unfolding, and he becomes increasingly weak-willed in the face of these horrors. And that's what was really on my mind. I wasn't necessarily that like jazzed about detailing the minutiae of the rich and privileged in Beverly Hills. You know, I was a literature major, okay? So I was thinking of a kind of a bigger picture when I was working on that book. But of course, because of, you know, the surface excitement, I guess, of the book, people tend to look at it as a voyeuristic joyride. That really was not my intention at all. I was a very serious-minded dude who had written three previous novels. Yeah, it's a novel. A serious-minded dude, by the way.
Serious? No, it's a novel. I mean,
yeah, so but, of course, it's a novel.
So now you're going to publish the sequel? Is that what the Imperial Bedroom is?
Yes, I am.
So it picks up with these characters in Frightening Thought in Middle Age?
This is correct.
And I'm sure you don't want to talk about a book too much that you have in progress, but can you just tell me how does middle age treat these people?
Well, look, there are, put it this way, there are better ways to deal with middle age than the way the people in this book are dealing with it. So, and a lot of it has to do with, I moved back out here, so I've been living in LA now for the past 3 years, and that's when I started writing the novel. And it definitely became much more informed by actually living here than I ever thought possible. And it really did become a study in a kind of pathological narcissism that I did not expect it to become when I first started working on the book or outlining it about, I don't know, 5 years ago when I was just like making notes on it. So yeah, that's a key to the new book. But yeah, and also Raymond Chandler. I've been rereading a lot of Raymond Chandler, and I wanted to kind of do a Raymond Chandler book, and it kind of all like, I don't know, fit into place, fell into place.
Do you think that you moved out to L.A. because you wanted to write this book in a sense to follow up on these characters, or were you just sick of New York?
I was just sick of New York. Mm-hmm. I was sick of New York. And I had, I had a lot of friends here and my family's out here. And also, I was getting work out here in terms of like screenwriting work and TV writing work. And I was interested in exploring that. What a mistake, by the way.
everyone goes through it, right? All of you guys.
It's so dumb. You know, there are so many casualties. And, you know, you still think that you're the one who's going to be able to beat it. That's retarded.
So you're not going to be Faulkner. You're not going to be Fitzgerald.
No. It's whatever. It was not the correct thing to do, I don't think. But regardless, I'm trying to figure out what the next move is. But anyway, it was a couple of reasons. I mean, New York did seem over to me. It did seem that you stayed. You know, you can stay too long at the party, and I was tired of the publishing world, and I was tired of going to book parties all the time and book gossip and, you know, just all my friends involved in publishing, and I don't know.
Yeah.
So, and I had a good run in New York. New York was really fun, and it was, but then it was just, you know, kind of time to see what else was out there.
I get it.
And so, yeah. But moving out to L.A. was not the reason. It had nothing to do with Imperial Bedrooms. It was a bunch of other stuff that all came together.
When you get into Patrick Bateman, and obviously you're not writing autobiographically, I assume, Brett, about dismemberment and murder and so on.
But American Psycho is my most autobiographical novel.
Can you explain that?
That's who I was. I mean, I don't, look, first of all, I've never come clean about whether I think Patrick Bateman committed the crimes or they were fantasies. And the book is completely open to interpretation. You make an argument either way about it. There are clues that say it didn't happen and he was fantasizing about this, and then there are other clues that suggest, well, hey, wait a minute, maybe he did do these things. But in terms of Patrick Bateman's loneliness and his alienation from the society he was a part of, I don't think I've ever written anything more autobiographical. I don't think I've ever identified with a character more, and I don't think that I probably ever will. I think a lot of what Patrick Bateman's, a lot of his misery, I connect with. And I connected with when I was writing the book. Now, of course, I wasn't murdering escort girls, and I wasn't, like, you know, attacking homeless people, but I'm not sure if he was either, and I'm not sure if those weren't just fantasies, rage-filled fantasies that were a reaction to the dullness and the banality and the anonymity of his everyday life. So writing that book was a way of dealing with being a young man in Manhattan in a kind of, I don't know, a yuppified culture that seemed to have blended and baby-proofed everything, and everything, everyone seemed obsessed with the wrong things. And I guess writing American Psycho was my reaction to that. But that is, and it remains, when I look back at that book, that most accurately captures what I was feeling and where I was going, more so than any of the other books I've written.
Well, it's interesting that you say he imagines. So in a way, it's not crucial whether it happened or didn't happen.
Well, does it make it any more interesting if it's answered? I don't think so.
No,
I
mean, it doesn't.
I mean, but it's the question that I'm constantly asked at every, you know, reading I give, or, you know, that's the question. And there's no answer to it because I don't have an answer to it. I didn't have an answer when I was writing it. I didn't know. I mean, I thought it could go either way. And it kept, you know, I kept flip-flopping while I was writing the book, and that became to me something very interesting.
Were you prepared, were you armored against the public outcry, the idea that misogynism and violence against women were going to be really, really disturbing themes?
You know, it was shocking when it happened, but I also believed in the book. But, you know, as foolish as it might have seemed in the spring of 1991, when the book came out and was completely condemned by the entire, you know, U.S. critical establishment, what I honestly believed was that they weren't writing about the book that I wrote. And my intentions were very different from how people initially perceived the book. I always thought that people were going to get the book. I always knew that either my generation was going to understand the book and relate to it. But, you know, now it remains probably my most popular novel and the one that keeps, you know, selling. And so, I always knew that people were going to get it. It was just a matter of waiting out that first couple of years. So I guess that's what kept me together in a way, knowing that the reaction to it had been hysterical and wrong, and that ultimately I think there's going to be an audience for it and people are going to get it. So that kept me afloat.
Well, that's interesting. It takes a lot of nerve to do that, but you have to, obviously, or you can't.
Well, what choice do you have?
No, well, you could just shut down. I know you give a lot of readings and talks. Do you experience your work differently after you've read it or while you're reading it? Does it give you insights?
You mean you're talking about like when I'm reading aloud?
Yeah.
Oh, God. You know, all the time. I mean, when I'm reading it, I'm thinking, why did I use that word? Why isn't this sentence better? Why didn't he say it this way? Why did the narrator decide to think this? I mean, and of course, you know, you've already read the work 100 times and you've signed off on it once, you know, it goes to print. But still, I mean, I can't pick up a book, any book right now and say, you know, I can read an entire page and go, oh, I changed that. Oh, I switched that word. I mean, it's a constantly evolving thing.
This is James Atlas, your host for Audible Modern Vanguard. Thanks very much for listening.
This has been an Audible Modern Vanguard production. For more Audible Modern Vanguard, please go to audible.com. Executive Producer, Maria Olson. Producers, Mike Charzik and Jason Ojalvo. Production Coordinator, Kat Lambrix. Engineered and directed by Nick Cameron and Elliot Glass. Edited by Scott Lubner and Ray Collins. Mixed and mastered by Eric Machado. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 1991 by Brett Easton Ellis. Production copyright 2009 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.